Hey, and welcome to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, and today's show is brought to us by Cabot Cheese. Cabot Cheese of Vermont, dairy farm family-owned since 1919 and proud to be voted your four-time champion cheddar. Look for the great taste of Cabot Cheddar in our favorite grocer's dairy case and on the web at CabotCheese.com. So, oddly enough, our sponsor is directly related to our subjects. Today we have, from Brooklyn Slate, Sean Tice and Christy Hedeka, and from Brooklyn Built, Andy Ring. Did I get everybody's names right?
It's actually Hedeka.
Hedeka. I knew that was the one I was worried about. Tice Ring, those are too easy. Well, this show is kind of about the craftspeople, so not necessarily the food brought to the table, but the vehicles for that food brought to the table. Brooklyn Slate is a company that started in the spring of 2009 when Sean and Chrissy visited Chrissy's family slate quarry in upstate New York. And how long has that been in your family, that quarry?
3 to 4 generations. I think the quarry that we're pulling our slate from has been in the family for 3 generations. I think my grandfather bought it in 1946.
And so onto your father, onto you, and
well, actually, it's my father and my uncle run them now, and then my older brother works there as well, and he'll probably take them over.
Excellent. And with that slate that you quarry, you make
slate cheese boards.
Ta-da! And Andy Ring is a woodworker. The majority of your work is bookcases, furniture, housewares,
exactly,
that kind of stuff. But I was in Brooklyn Larder one day, and Sergio, one of the owners, pointed out a cutting cheese charcuterie board to me that was very distinct, had hardwood accents handle, but this kind of black top, which initially I thought was slate. But when you get closer, it's actually a substance called richolite.
Richolite, that's it. It's made out of recycled paper, and it's fused together with dye under high pressure. And yeah, it's a countertop material, really.
Cool. And I noticed that you said it was FSC certified.
Yeah, just that's a recycled green certification.
Excellent. And it's coated with resin. It's durable. It's
yeah, it's totally... It's very similar to wood, except that it's not porous in any way. I was at a demonstration where a guy had put a piece of richlite in a bucket of water for like a month, and he pulled it out and dried it off and weighed it, and it weighed exactly the same as before it had been in the water. So it's a pretty amazing material.
Yeah, and it was funny, when I was emailing with you too, you mentioned that it also develops a patina that's similar to that of slate.
Yeah,
which I thought was a great roundabout cyclical way to bring both Brooklyn Built. And let me clarify too, it's BrooklynBILT.com.
Yes.
And Brooklyn Slate is, well, spell it out, .com. To bring Brooklyn Slate back into the conversation, the quarry itself, the rocks, use a whole bunch of machinery to actually take in this material. Can you talk through the process? Because quarries are a foreign idea to me.
The rock is blasted. My father has a blasting license, and so they...
Can you just say that again?
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, that's an excellent pickup line.
Maybe so, not.
They blow up the stone, and it falls, and then they pick it up. He has humongous machines. They look like moon mobiles. They're these humongous dump trucks and backhoes and bucket loaders, and... they get these big boulders and they bring them up from the pit into the yard, and then they use a pavement cleaver and they break them down into smaller parts, and then they actually drill the smaller rocks with a jackhammer and they insert, looks like a humongous nail, and they tap it back and forth for it, just like small taps, and then the slate will actually crack along the grain, because slate is like metamorphized shale, so it forms in sheets. So if you flip it on its side, it'll split evenly. And so then they take those smaller blocks and they bring it in and they cut it with these saws. They're sort of like water saws that are, the water pours over the saw to keep the dust down, and they get extremely hot. And they cut them into smaller blocks, and then they actually again use a like a cleaving device, and they hit it with a hammer, and it breaks again into more sheets, and then they trim it. And we have a trimming machine as well that we trim the slate with. So we actually don't have boulders in our
yeah,
studio.
I was about to say, that seems like a lot of specialized machinery have in a South Brooklyn studio.
No.
And then it's transported down already in slate form, or in the finished Brooklyn slate form?
No, it's not in the finished form. We actually have a studio upstate at the quarry as well now, just because we outgrew our studio here very quickly and don't have the capital to buy our own huge warehouse. But so we do part of the manufacturing upstate, and then part of it is done in Brooklyn. Most of the packaging is all done in Brooklyn. And like I said, we have a trimming machine, so we can cut custom pieces in Brooklyn as well. So we just split our time, actually, between the two spaces.
And right now, aside from the product itself, what I find fascinating, too, is the thought that went behind the packaging. That I think Sean had emailed me that every piece of packaging can be repurposed. It's a, what, a burlap sack? And
There's a burlap sack that you can use to either store the slate or just use as a placemat. Or for other purposes, too.
Yeah.
And then there's, you know, we package an envelope which can be reused with twine, and that also can be reused
as a cat toy. I've been using mine as a cat toy. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Excellent. And what was interesting to find out, too, Christy and Sean are kind of hydra-heading this, you know, project, and I was talking about how nice it is to see design be so methodical versus some kind of artisan products that sometimes are whimsical and temporal. And Sean said, well, I'm the methodical one. Chrissy's the one that usually not flies off the handle, but they hone each other in that sense. How did the idea actually come about? You know, I mean, you've had this quarry in your family for generations upon generations. Why now?
I think it was sort of situational. Like, Sean had just was working for CBS as a graphic designer and did some web work for them, and he had been laid off, and I was just starting school at Parsons to do a graduate program, and we were both sort of looking for something, something to give us a little bit more direction, like a project. And we were taking the train to Vermont, and we went through Murray's in Grand Central, and I saw some, and I'd always known that they existed. And so I showed Sean, and I was like, you know, we can do this. And we went to the quarry when we got up to Vermont, and my father showed us some pieces, and he was like, you know, you can take these and do what you want. And he showed us how to seal it, and then we just started, I guess we put our own little, it's Sean did the graphic for the logo.
I mean, we had like these initial conversations, and we essentially had like a logo and a website before we had a product. We were just like, let's like make this into something.
Yeah. And it's kind of like when people are in high school and they get their band and they do the band name first, and yeah, forget about the music.
You got stickers and everything.
Yeah. And then now I'm looking at actually the Brooklyn built too. Your design, your idea behind these things, because Andy, like I said, is a woodworker and deals mainly in furniture and housewares and, you know, bookcases and that sort. And why the transition into?
Well, in a way, it's kind of the green thing, too, or recycling, in that originally the first cutting boards I made, if you're doing a kitchen for somebody, you have to cut out the opening for the sink. So I had all these pieces of Richlite that were sink-shaped left over. And I didn't want to throw them out. I have tons of scraps of wood, and I was like, what can I make out of this? And woodworkers always make cutting boards. I mean, if you look on a woodworking forum, it's like half of it's like,
how many woodworking firms are there?
A lot.
Yeah.
But I mean, all my friends who are in the business are, you know, oh, November, I've got to be making cutting boards for Christmas kind of thing. So it was natural to make a cutting board, but I didn't want to make another normal, you know, wood cutting board. And I was like, oh, the Richlite's great. And I made a couple that were just Richlite, and they were nice, but I kind of like having the wood involved in it, too. And, you know, just kind of through trial and error, ended up with the design that you see in front of you. So
yeah. And I'm saying, if you do see this, initially, a lot of the times, I'd assume people mistake it for, like, chalkboard or, you know.
Yeah, a lot of people think it's soapstone.
Yeah.
Because it has a heavy. The funny thing, being here with these guys is, when I first started working with Richlite, I went to a certification course, and half the people at the course were stone fabricators for stone countertops, and the other half were woodworkers, and their approach to it was completely different. The stone guys were like, wow, this material is so light.
Yeah.
And all the woodworkers were like, this stuff weighs a ton.
Yeah.
But it's somewhere in between wood and stone
In
terms of its feel and its weight. I mean, these guys would probably not think it feels like stone, whereas I pick it up and I think it does because I'm used to wood. But.
Yeah, yeah. But it's possibly just a great amalgam of the two.
Yeah.
And then going a little into the process, because when we had discussed what you do with this wood and how you make these boards, it was lost on me. Like terms like, what were they? Laid up, pegged, doweled, sanded, coated. Can you kind of like take us through those steps?
Sure. Well, the board is, the cutting part of the board is made out of Richlite, and then there's a handle that comes off of that that's wood. And the wood piece and the Richlite piece are connected, if you look at the board, with a spline, which is a third piece, which is made out of wood that is kind of notched into both the Richlite and the wooden handle. And then, as extra insurance and kind of for aesthetic purposes, there's a little peg that goes through and holds the Richlite and the handle, the spline, together. And gluing that all up is called laying it up. And then, so that's the initial assembly. And then the whole thing's sanded, and it's, you know, I've got a machine that routes the edges and puts that kind of curve on it. And then the final step is applying a finish to it, which is I've experimented with different things. The Richlite has a non-toxic finish that they suggest people put on their countertops. Sometimes I use that, and sometimes I just put mineral oil on it. Lots of sanding. And
so it's not just picking up a piece of wood and eating some cheese off of it.
No.
And actually, speaking of mineral oil, because both Brooklyn Slate and Brooklyn Built use that application to make it food safe. And Andy, you had mentioned that you use beeswax sometime. Mm-hmm. Did you go through a long process at Brooklyn Slate as well, trying to figure out what to use?
We did. And actually, we were sort of lucky. There's a company in the town where one of the quarries is that does soapstone, and they do a lot of countertops. And he had suggested that we use this food safe mineral oil. Then he suggested we use this sort of wax too, and it just didn't. The slate, it's just sort of hard to apply it. The issue we run into is that after we initially wash the slate and then we apply the oil, and then we actually have to wash it again to get any sort of residue off of it, because it will absorb only so much, and then it stains our hang tags, actually, is what happens.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Excellent. You know, aside from these just being situational pieces, you know, put some cheese, put some meat, serve it to a table, there's also a deeper connection with both companies to food. Brooklyn Slate is coming out with kind of like a gift pack for the holidays that Christy and Sean were explaining to me. And who's inclusive of that?
We have Ted and Honey, who's over in Cobble Hill. Shelburne Farms up in Burlington produces cheddar. Castleton Crackers. And Brooklyn Slate.
Yeah. And it wasn't just you plucking these things out of thin air. You inherently knew or met some of these producers before.
Definitely, yeah. I think the conversation sort of started when we met Whitney from Castleton Crackers, and she produces several different flavors of cracker, which are all very delicious. And we thought, why don't we try and pair this with other things? And you pair all that on a piece of slate. It just seems sort of logical. So the next step was to find someone that could maybe produce jams or chutneys that would complement the crackers really well. And we met Ted actually at a market here in Brooklyn, and he was very excited by the idea. So it sort of just came together pretty much in the way that we wanted it to come together, in terms of like working with other producers and making something that is a complement to each thing in it.
Yeah, excellent. And have you had a lot of other companies, businesses approach you to maybe be part of that larger package?
No, we did try and reach out to some people at first and didn't actually hear back. I think that it was just sort of, it was more trial and error. And when we found someone who was interested and it felt right, we went with that. So we ended up actually going with I think we were going to bring in different people to make the jams and chutneys and try a different, like a variety. And then Ted, actually, when we went to him with the offer, he wrote us this email back with these amazing, like an amazing list of chutneys, and had completely gone overboard, and it was great. And so we decided just to go with him because he was very into the idea of, and he tasted all the crackers, and we had told him that we wanted to use a cheddar, and he came up with all the combinations for us. So we just sort of went from there.
Yeah. I mean, talk about Slate being a vehicle for food. I mean, it's, you know, got passengers too, that you bring new products to the table that wouldn't otherwise necessarily have been in Brooklyn by, you know.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think too, part of the idea sort of came too from seeing all these other producers here in Brooklyn. And it's like, how can we sort of bring these people together that we meet at different events over time? And of course, we've worked with some people that are not in Brooklyn, but we'd like to see more of that all put on a piece of Slate together, yeah. You know.
Excellent. We're going to take a quick break and talk about the larger community, and these recent travels to Paris and Normandy. Uh-huh. Maybe if they were inspiration for the foods then put on his Brooklyn-built plates. And yeah, we'll be right back. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.com.
The New England and New York farm families who own Cabot Cooperative are offering listeners a chance to win some of the world's best cheddar simply by calling into our show at 718-497-2128 or emailing us at info@heritageradionetwork.com. What a great way to start the holidays. I'll be picking a winner for the program 2 weeks from today. Cabot Creamery is a proud supporter of what Heritage Radio is all about.
You're listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Brooklyn Built, that's B-I-L-T, and Brooklyn Slate. I'm going to spell that out this time, S-L-A-T-E. I just wanted to see if I can actually do that. I'm a terrible speller. But we were just talking about community, and I actually wanted to touch on Andy's recent travels to Paris and Normandy. I'm just started reading this book, to all that. It's a Michael, I think, Steinberger book about the change in France from like 2002 to now, and cuisine, and how family meals have devolved from like 88 minutes to 38 minutes, but there's still that central part of maybe like the cheese board, charcuterie. When you were over in Paris, and what were you there for specifically?
I was just there for pleasure with my girlfriend, who's half French, half American.
Yeah, and you guys went to Paris and traveled to Normandy. How much cheese and charcuterie did you eat? Because I'm trying to live vicariously.
Well, first of all, I'm here to say that the family meal is still well and
vibrant. Yeah,
and at least 55 minutes or
yeah.
whatever the number was.
Yeah.
And that's lunch and dinner.
Excellent. I mean, it's so sad to kind of see, well, even Brooklyn Built stuff and Brooklyn Slate stuff be thought of as like special occasion. I mean, I would use this at every freaking meal, like breakfast, lunch, dinner, and be completely fine with it. And it's not me just blowing smoke up everybody's ass, but the idea of bringing things out for special occasions mm-hmm. and not making every occasion you know, extraordinary, I think should be, you know.
Well, that's another interesting thing about France that struck me is that their use of kitchenware, I guess, or, you know, plates and special glasses and not special, fancy. I mean, there's much more emphasis on the table.
Not IKEA.
Like, yeah, and pairing, you don't just use the same plates every day. There's you know, and that struck me when I was there, definitely.
Excellent. So, I mean, trying to push these into the light of not just being a one-off, you know, a holiday, a Thanksgiving, a Christmas. Is that something that both of you are trying to push forwards, that these are actually utilitarian?
Yeah, definitely. I just have to say from our experience, making the slate cheese board is a really good excuse to buy cheese pretty much more than you should. So yeah. It's really become sort of a normal thing to like plate it. And I enjoy that sort of transition.
Excellent. I mean, not to step on Ann Saxelby's Cutting the Curd show, who has airs on Sundays, but let's talk about cheese. I mean, what are your favorite things to put on these boards? Be it cheese, be it meat, be it condiments, be it anything outside of the box.
You know, there used to be a restaurant in Greenpoint that used our slate cheese boards, and they did some really amazing stuff, like put I can't remember what it was, the hummus.
It was a chickpea crusted calamari, and he was serving all types of different things on the slate.
And we're like, this is it. Like, it doesn't just have to be cheese. Like, you can, and it really looks great on a piece of black slate as opposed to a plate. You
know? Yeah. I think for Christmas, my girlfriend and I do a dessert party, and I think we used the, we gave her mother the gift of, or her parents the gift of Brooklyn slate, and it was one of those, like, why didn't we give that to ourselves? But we used it when we were there. I think we put like little tartlets or some kind of desserts all over, and it's a fantastic you know, not just vehicle but display. I mean, it's brings up the prominence of, you know, certain foods.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it's been really great for us because in addition to that restaurant, we've been working with more restaurants, and we do like restaurants to plate different foods on the slate, but it's also great to go and meet with the farms. Like, we went to Consider Bardwell in Paulet, Vermont, and we've met with Mateo from Jasper Hill, and just going and seeing these cheesemakers is also really inspirational to us as far as doing something creative that,
you can also eat or eat off of.
Yeah.
It sort of all comes full circle. But yeah, that's a nice thing about it.
Yeah, but I mean, has it changed the way you approach your product too? I mean, the majority of slate have 90-degree angles, be it square, rectangle. Are there ever evolutions to, you know, circles, ovals, different shapes?
I mean, we're definitely always improving the product, as I'm sure Andy is as well. I mean, one of the big sort of like changes that we made, if you can call it a change, is we started to round the edges. We think both is like sort of a safety precaution, but also like it feels good, like it looks good, and you know, there's little tweaks that we'll make over time. But but in terms of producing different cuts, like, we feel pretty good about the squares and rectangles right now.
Yeah. And Andy, I mean, with your cheese boards too.
Well, I was going to jump in and say that actually, the reason mine has a handle on it, or one of the reasons, is that you can use rich light to actually cut on. So I use the board a lot for presentation, but also for cooking. And the handle, you cut and you have, you know, whatever on it, you can just walk it over to the garbage can and sweep everything off. Whereas with the big rectangular cutting board, it's much, you know, it's not as easy. So it's actually a very good for the utility of actually cooking with.
Yeah. But what about maybe counterweighting and having two handles so you can bring it out? You know, like, I'm thinking Thanksgiving, big turkey. try, you know, counterbalancing an 8, 10, you know, 20 pounder on those things.
Nice. And,
yeah. Or a pizza. I mean, we're, you know, having Roberta's right now. These are great.
I was thinking of making a pizza with a peel.
Oh, excellent.
Out of rich light, actually.
Cool. No, that's awesome. And, I mean, what is the heat transference of rich light?
It transference in the sense of it keeping stuff warm, or whether it's going to flammability.
Well, now I'd like to know both.
I don't really know per se.
Yeah.
I mean, it's basically the equivalent of a wood, so of a really, really dense wood. So it doesn't, I've put really hot stuff down on it, and rich light in its countertop you know, guise or whatever, says that it you know, is basically impervious to putting a hot pan or whatever down on it. And I did make a pizza peel for myself and have used it to pull pizzas out of, not a wood burning pizza oven, but a
conventional,
a tweaked, where you screw with the self-cleaning function on a regular oven.
Oh yeah.
Because a regular oven, I guess for FCC, whatever you can only bring up to 500 degrees, but the oven's capable of going much hotter.
Oh, so it's like taking a car, drilling a hole to let more, you know.
Well, you do something that allows you to open the oven when it's doing its self-cleaning thing, which allows you to cook pizza at a higher temperature, which is what pizza needs.
I'd like to note that you added on that secondary question of flammability, and now I know why, because I'd like to come to your house and see all the kind of add-ons that you have to most of your wares. I may try that. Because I was just talking about pizza with somebody, and that you can only get to 500,
right,
maybe 550 in a degree in an oven, and it's not a consistent, you know, temperature.
And the whole trick is to get to 800 or 900.
Yeah, for quick New York style pizzas. Huh, interesting. Well, I might
try this at home.
No, well, I am going to, but I'm going to wait till after Thanksgiving is done and over with. So I will be eating out most of December after I ruin my stove. outside of your boards, too, did you guys look at any other housewares or, you know, ways of cooking in the kitchen as influence onto your product design?
I mean, for us, I think most of it just, we find, like, visual signifiers and other, I think more just, like, in abstract things, like textures and, especially, like, ideas of, like, old industry, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, like, thinking about maybe, like, a really old stove and, like, how that was designed in the 20s. Like, that's the sort of thing that we try to incorporate, I think.
Yeah, what kind of research have you been doing lately?
Fonts.
Yeah.
Enjoy looking at old fonts and trying to integrate those or use those as a jumping off point for producing different, you know, like, marketing materials or postcards, that kind of thing.
I mean, just even letterpresses seem very culinary sometimes.
Yes, yeah.
Just with the materials that they use and the way that they operate, so... when I was in school in Boston, there were a whole bunch of type foundries, and I used to go there, and at first you walk in, you don't know whether or not it's like a cotton mill, like weaving blankets, type foundry, or some kind of like cooking element thing. But yeah, I can see that playing in. So you're looking at fonts to further your logo, further your design, or?
Yeah, well, I think it's half and half. Part is like, I mean, how do we want to present the slate and how do we want it to feel? And we think about that a lot when we do like our own photography for the website.
Yeah.
And we like to make postcards and that kind of thing. So when we think about the setting and the backdrop and what we want to plate on it, part of it is like, what kind of food do we think would be appealing, but also what type of setting feels really comfortable. And for some reason, type foundries and really rusty old things come into play.
I was supposed to say, you drive out to Pennsylvania, hit up some Mennonites and... Well, you were also speaking of this absurd barn is it upstate New York or
Shelburne Farms, who we're getting cheddar from. This barn is just, I mean, it's hard to conceive or describe how large it is. It's pretty much like a semi-skyscraper turned sideways.
Wow.
And made entirely of wood.
Yeah, I was just going to quantify it bigger than a bread barn.
There was some stone, that's right.
And what was it used for? I mean, is it functionally used as a cheese-making facility now?
It is, and there are classrooms as well in it, and I'm not really sure what the other spaces are.
The other 85% of the building.
Yeah. Jeez. And you guys are at capacity, both Brooklyn Built and Brooklyn Slate, as far as materials held, right? Like, you don't have any space for anything, and they have 85% of their...
We should be talking about them.
Yeah, yeah. May everyone check out Shelburne Farms for some rentals. I was going to say any parting words, but... That's not what this is. Any last words about your products, about what you hope, you know, new connections to make, or what you hope to get out of maybe even critical commentary or criticism to help improve what you're doing?
Well, for me, this really was kind of a... It's interesting. I was watching a documentary the other day, a PBS documentary called Crafts in America, and it had all these amazingly successful like basket makers and Sam Maloof, who's a great furniture maker, And it was kind of interesting how many of them had started just by being at the stage that I am now, of kind of having made something that they liked themselves, and their friends found out about it, and then they ended up creating a business, and then it ended up being a relatively large business. And for me, the cutting boards, I am very interested in food, and that's why I made the cutting board, but the cutting boards are the first kind of experiment into doing other products, which, you know, I'm kind of ramping up the cutting board thing as a experience, but hopefully we'll be coming out with some other products.
Yeah, you think you could drop one of those, a little preview here for us?
There's too many different things kind of floating. None of them are past the kind of prototype stage.
Yeah, but if you have any ideas for Andy as well, I'm sure he'd appreciate an email or a call. So check out brooklynbuilt.com, and that's BILT.com, Andy Ring, and then brooklynslate.com with Christy
Hattica.
I was so close. See, I do this to try to get over the fear of speaking. Then names like yours come in here. And then Sean Tice, thank you both for bringing your excellent wares, your stories behind it, and you know, the food to the table. You never know what's going to be your stepping stone, soapstone, slate, rich light. Start a project now and contact these two for excellent products of their own. You've been listening to The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Thanks again to Cabot Cheese for sponsoring, Jack Inslee for producing, Nate Wiener for engineering, and hope to have you here Tuesday, 3 p.m. next week. Cheers.
Thanks for tuning into The Food Scene on Heritage Radio Network today, guys. Later today, 5 p.m., tune into Beer Sessions Radio. We've got a really good one planned, followed by that, Why We Cook at 6:30. And then we'll see you again on Thursday. Again, you've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com.